Right, well, thanks for coming. My name is Ruth Kinner, and I'm here actually promoting Anarchist Studies, which is a journal run out of Loughborough, and it publishes papers by those in academia and those outside on a variety of different issues. It's interdisciplinary, and it's 10 quid a go. It's discounted today, and we're downstairs if you want to buy one. And the other reason I'm here is because there are a few of us now at Loughborough University who work on anarchism, and we're sort of cobbled together as a group launching various projects, two of which are more recent, and this one, which is mine, is less recent. This was published at the end of 2009, Anarchism and Utopianism, and it's co-edited with a colleague of mine, Lawrence Davis. And it's a collection of essays which looks at the intersection of anarchism and utopianism. And I suppose, I mean, it brings together writers who work from very different perspectives. So from history of ideas, history, literature, gay, queer studies, and political theory. And they all try in different ways to think about the ways in which anarchism is a utopian project, and equally the extent to which utopianism is or is not inherently anarchistic. And I suppose it has two sort of principal themes in it, and one of those is a sort of a negative theme, and that's to debunk myths about anarchism as a fixed goal or a blueprint, something that you can design and march into, and that's all settled and established, and that we can somehow anticipate what a new world, a better world, will look like, and that you don't have to think about it too much. And that's a criticism that's often raised about anarchism, that they're sort of hopeless utopians, people who think in an almost quasi-religious sense of what life is like after some catastrophic revolution, and that we can somehow delay living in alternative ways because we know that in the future there's going to be this great, fantastic sort of heavenly space that we can all occupy unproblematically. So that was one thing the book tried to do, is to say that, well, anarchism isn't about that, and it never has actually been about that. And the other thing was to think, therefore, about, well, what different sorts of ways could you think about the relationship? And that was really, I think, most of the answers that came out of the work, out of the essays in this collection, were really about a sort of a politics of hope, if you like, a way in which you might think about reimagining ways of living, reimagining different sets of social relationships, thinking about how you could bring those into practice, thinking about the ways in which anarchists have in the past tried to bring those things into practice. So the idea was that anarchism isn't the utopianism that is often, or it's often criticised for being, but it is utopian in the sense that it is about radical imageries, different prospects, different concepts, but those concepts and ways of living can be initiated in the present, with a view to moving fluidly into better practices.
What about utopianism in the sense of naivety? Because I think a lot of anarchism is utopian in that respect, in a kind of naive, simplistic respect. And the stuff that I've read in there, I don't remember touching on that. But is that touched on at all, or is that something that...
Not in a kind of systematic way. I think there's an argument, I mean, there's a particular argument in the book about the extent to which you can... or the only way, or the best way in which anarchism is utopian is to leave it completely open. So you simply, the act of desiring, the act of wishing, the act of hoping is sufficiently, or is sufficient in itself as a political project. And one of the criticisms of that view is that that doesn't take us anywhere. It doesn't actually show, or it doesn't encourage anyone to think very constructively about the kind of the nitty-gritty. And that, if you like, there's a balance, therefore, to be struck between something which is fixed as a blueprint and something which is completely fluid, and that the trick is to think of more practical ways which are utopian but also have some bearing on the reality, rather than just say, oh well, I can wish, I can hope, I can live in a different way, and that's it, that's the end of my politics. Now, I think there's an argument about that, but it doesn't sort of then further engage into the sorts of things that you do in your work and sort of start really questioning the extent to which you can expect that, you know, people will behave differently as anarchists, or there won't be the sorts of problems that you encounter in contemporary society in any kind of other context. No, it doesn't look at those. It's looking much more at the broad sort of sweeps, yeah, if you like.
Is it available at all the bookshops?
Well, it's not very available. Unfortunately, we tried very hard to get it published by someone who would make it affordable, but it's published by Manchester University Press, and it's very unaffordable. But I guess in the long term, if it doesn't sell, we can buy the rights and then maybe publish it with someone who will make it more affordable.
You have to buy the rights back.
Yeah, you have to buy the rights back.
But presumably people could order it from their library.
They could order it for their libraries, and yeah, that would be very helpful.
So
yeah.
This is also ridiculously unaffordable, but I did have two bits of paper to make it 50% less ridiculously unaffordable, which still makes it pretty unaffordable, but I forgot to bring them, so if anyone bizarrely was interested in getting a copy, then I do have these things, but they need to be used by the end of this month, actually, funnily enough. But yeah, I think if anyone is interested in this, or Ruth's, then like getting it for the library is about the only way you're really going to do it. So this is a book, of edited collections, edited papers that I did with a guy called Benjamin Franks. It's called Anarchism and Moral Philosophy, and it does pretty much what it says on the cover. It's it stemmed from a frustration that I have and Ben had has with anarchists' general kind of at best ambivalence towards ethics and ethical discussions and kind of moral discussions. It's an academic book, so it's kind of moral philosophy. Most of it's quite accessible, I think, to the kind of non-academic. There's some bits that are kind of a bit more heavy and might need a bit more kind of understanding of the kind of wider debates, but most of it's fairly accessible. But it was a general kind of feeling that anarchism or anarchists have this kind of ambivalence to morality, to ethics. I found a nice little quote which I've lost again already on my way from home to here, from a little pamphlet. I was just going to check if it was in here. I don't think it is. But there's a quote that I always like from Emma Goldman, and I was hoping it was on this piece of paper, but I don't think it is now. But she talks about the monster of morality quite a lot, and blames all sorts of things on morality. And that's quite a common trope within anarchism. So there's actually quite a strong dismissal of morality and of ethics. And like I say, at best, there's this kind of ambivalence. And I think that kind of stems from this idea that morality is about interference, and we kind of have this idea of morality coming from the church or from the state, and morality is about interfering with people. And this quote that was from the East Midlands Anarchist Group
talks about anarchism being not being interested in morality and the moral interference of other people. But then it goes on to qualify it, although it doesn't really kind of acknowledge that it's a qualifying statement, but it does, and it goes on to say there's no right to interfere with anyone except when they're harming others. And that, of course, is the big kind of, the big question, is that kind of except when they're causing harm. And that, of course, is what all morality is about. It's about the idea that something's wrong and you try to stop it, or you make a judgment against it. And anarchists will do that just as much as anyone else, and they might use different means to do it, and they might think about it differently, but there's still a kind of judgment about things. And that's why, of course, anarchism exists, because there's a judgment that the state is wrong, there's a judgment that capitalism is wrong. And even the kind of judgment that morality is wrong is a moral judgment. You can't get out of that. It's a kind of paradox. But and even a kind of claim for complete freedom, complete liberty, completely open libertarian position is still a moral position. So Ben and I wanted to kind of bring some of this into the kind of anarchist scene a bit more, and get people more openly kind of talking about things in a kind of ethical manner. So there's three different sections, pretty broad scope of interest. There's some things that look quite specifically at different thinkers. There's one on Proudhon, there's one about Nietzsche. There are some more philosophical papers, the first three are much more kind of contextualising the philosophy of anarchism. My paper kind of talks about some of the thinking behind the book, and some of the things that I've just been talking about there, so the fact that there's always a kind of value judgment in what we do, even if we don't think of it as morality. Ben, who co-edited the book with myself, tries to kind of define an anarchist ethics using kind of virtue ethics, which is a kind of moral theory. This stuff about deep ecology and primitivism, a bit of the debate with kind of Murray Bookchin and so on. It's not overly academic. I think it's fairly kind of accessible and fairly broad in its scope. The one really kind of unifying thing is the kind of emphasis, the explicit emphasis on ethics. But because, in a way, our thinking behind the book was that that's always there, it was really an attempt to draw that out. So lots of the articles could easily appear in somewhere else. It's not this really heavily, you don't necessarily read it all and think, oh God, this is all really heavy moral philosophy. It's just kind of making explicit the fact that this moral underpinning to anarchist theory, as there is to everything. I think that's it, really.
You said about sort of the in anarchist movement, a lot of time is sort of the stance is taken is almost like a sort of a mill harm principle type thing, where it's like if it's not causing harm, then it's all right. And where do you draw the line? Do you think that is a necessarily like a detrimental view then for like to there to be within the anarchist movement, or should there be like a greater clarification of a sort of an ethics then within the movement?
I don't think that's necessarily bad in and of itself. I think what's bad is when there's this idea that there's a kind of supposedly neutral or non or amoral space where what you're doing is preventing harm, and then anything else is kind of moral interference. But of course, how you define harm is a moral question. You know, is killing an animal harm? Is kind of keeping a woman in the kitchen harm? Is, you know, is being gay harmful to children? Is you know, is being homophobic harmful? So there's not a kind of objective criteria by which we can define harm, and I think that's what is often overlooked. So it's kind of, it's about saying you need to recognise that when you say I'm against harm, that's a kind of moral position, and that's a value position, and it might conflict with what other people see as being harmful. And it's about being clear about that rather than saying that's wrong in itself. It's kind of understanding the values that underpin those judgments. And I think often there's a feeling, which is very much, which I talk about in my paper, very much like the kind of liberal attitude, actually, that this is kind of neutral space, and that's what the state is supposed to do. It's just supposed to prevent harm, and it's not supposed to interfere in our moral lives. But of course, as we all know, the way the state defines what's harmful comes from its own kind of position and reflects its own values, and it can't escape that. An individual in an anarchist society wouldn't be able to escape that. So that's kind of that's the issue, really, I think.
This question, I've got a four-year-old daughter, and she often asks me, why can't I just do what I want? I have these kind of ethical kind of type debates more often than not with a four-year-old, and it's quite interesting. It's, you know, and I'd say to her, you know, what you've been saying is, I think people should do what they want, unless you're doing anything that's harmful or hurts anyone else. So, you know, so don't annoy your brother. Don't, you know, don't crush that insect. Don't, you know, because that wouldn't be nice for the insect. And, you know, it's kind of on that level of stuff. And I don't know, that's that seems to me to be a very concrete, solid kind of need for the answers to these questions is when you're being asked it by your daughter.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, because I think the you know, children don't come with all these kind of assumptions that we've learned by the time we're adults, and then we think we know what's right and wrong, and we often assume that it's objectively so, and we don't question it. So your daughter's probably, in fact, it would be great to bring your daughter to kind of most anarchist events and get her to ask all sorts of questions, like, why are you opposed to the state? Why don't you like this? Why don't you like that? And that's what we need, really. And that's what philosophers, more humble ones, quite often say is a good philosopher doesn't provide good answers, they ask good questions. And I think that's really kind of at the heart of a lot of good academia, is kind of asking the right questions, kind of, you know, and saying, actually, we can't just take that for granted. Why do you do that? And it's even harder when, with your daughter, when you can't just fall back on easy rhetoric and catchphrases and so on, because they'll just keep on asking, why? You can't just say, you know, well, because I'm an anarchist. They'll say, what's an anarchist? And you can't just give her, like, mutual aid and say, well, read that, leave me alone. You have to kind of search. And it's interesting to also realise that you don't necessarily always have, like, it's not just about explaining yourself, it's about trying to find the answers yourself.
But presumably when you talk to your daughter, you know, part of what you're doing is not just explaining or trying to explain what you think harms might be. It is much broader, isn't it? It's a kind of flattening out process about moral norms and what sorts of conventions you would ideally like your child or children to follow, and in a sense I think that's really where the Emma Goldman, the monster of morality, comes in, because what she's complaining about is not having to have any ethics. It's about having to accept somebody else's moral norms and being able to open those up to question without completely throwing them out the window. And I think that's the really tough thing, that it's not just how you speak to your children, but that you then become aware of the sorts of values and norms that you really want to embed. And they become problematic in lots of different ways. And I don't know whether the book sort of engages with those, but in a sense I think you're being slightly unfair to Emma Goldman, because, you know, she's writing against a society where the norms, if you like, have become so obviously repressive and that the ways to escape those was not to say, well, we don't want any kind of ethics, but to say we want to be able to have some space to transgress, and to do that in a way that allowed space for everyone to do it, rather than to say, which was the elitist answer, I want to be able to transgress, but actually I want you people there to have your moral norms against which I can define my genius. And that's a different set of issues, it seems to me, from thinking about, you know, what constitutes harm. It's actually about the ways in which we develop a whole set of social relationships.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I obviously didn't kind of go into any detail with that. I think just what I wanted to highlight was the kind of the way... I still think she's wrong to talk about the monster of morality. I think I can see it's a kind of rhetorical device, but she means the way morality is... She means certain values and the way those values are applied, which is what you're saying. But the idea of morality being a monster is problematic, and I think some of her writing does, and certainly a lot of anarchist writing does imply this kind of this objective view of there being a kind of a right and a wrong, or something that's useful, or a freedom that's kind of uninhibited by values, and lots of anarchist writing and lots of all writing contradicts itself, and obviously, Emma Goldman talks about the transvaluation of values, the kind of old Nietzschean thing, and she recognises values, but in other contexts, she writes as though we can kind of transgress values entirely, and I think that's quite a common trope. So, and it's always bad to pick out on one individual when you're kind of critiquing a whole ideology in a way. So I don't mean to single out Emma Goldman as being particular. In fact, she was one of the, in my view, one of the kind of one of the people who was more wise to these things than lots of people, which in a way makes it more interesting that she kind of comes out with these sorts of things. So it wasn't a stab at her so much as this kind of just that need to recognise that problem. And yeah, I think the responsibility of like embedding your values onto a child as well is interesting, and how you do that and how you give them space to grow as an individual. Clearly you're going to influence them, and clearly you're going to want to influence them. You know, you don't want your child to grow up to be a little Tory. but you don't want to kind of force your values down their throat, and it's a real tension. Come into terms with that.
Yes, I guess that's Butchin's problem, isn't it?
Butchin's bank sprang to mind. Do you want to?
I have a copy of the. Has anyone hasn't said anything, want to say anything?
No, and I think there'll be time at the end to come back and talk about it.
Well, I will be talking about two publications, both on post-anarchism. One of them you can buy, one of them you can download. The one you can download is the magazine, Anarchist Developments in Cultural Studies, which is on the website anarchistdevelopments.org, and all articles can be downloaded. I will talk about it after the book. And the other one, this post-anarchism reader, we with Duane Roussel from Canada, we made these two projects actually. The idea of this reader, the post-anarchism reader, was at the same time make a kind of present a comprehensive volume which includes all the key texts of the debate on post-structuralism and anarchism and the discussions around it, and at the same time show different positions within the post-anarchism and within the post-structuralist anarchist milieu. So we made the book in a way to reflect that. And it starts with When Anarchism Met Post-Structuralism section, where we put some key texts from Andrew Cove, Todd May, Sol Neiman, and Hakim Bey. And then these texts are key texts because they've been cited a lot, discussed a lot afterwards. And whenever people mentioned something about post-anarchism, these were the texts that were mostly came to mind. And then we had another section about when post-anarchism hits the streets, where we, you know, there's always this accusation of being too much theoretical, and then this debates around activism and academics in mostly in the Anglophone world. And so that part about the activist approaches to post-anarchism. Also, we had a very strong anarchism debate about classical anarchism and new or post-anarchism versus which was a debate itself, was faulty, but at least we wanted to put some of the examples. Of course, we couldn't put all of them. Maybe we kind of chose the most harsh ones, I guess. That just people were mainly, as you will remember, attacking post-anarchism because they, mostly Sol Neiman and Todd May, the way they represented classical anarchism because of that. And so we put them as well. And then the last section was Lines of Flight, which was also very much provided material for the journal too, because there we kind of observed that today there are a lot of anarchist theoricians who are not only working on anarchism, who are not just making new theories on anarchism itself, but anarchism is becoming a much more used radical tool to understand or to change all disciplines in all areas, from geography to literature to technology and different disciplines. So we wanted to create a platform to reflect that and at the same time encourage more people to do this kind of research, because before it was just the Marxism which was used as the radical tool to whenever someone wanted to apply a radical left approach to anthropology or geography or history, they were thinking that the only framework could be radical Marxism. But nowadays we have many people thinking otherwise and kind of experimenting with anarchist ideas in different disciplines, which is pretty exciting for us. So we, in this journal, Post-Anarchism Today, was the special issue on Post-Anarchism Today. Of course, the second issue will be on Anarchism and Art, edited by Ellen Antliff. So here we have, for example, an article on an anarchist film theory, or a discussion about anarchism and Marxism, or another one on architecture, anarchist spaces, etc. Just reflecting a broad spectrum that we are now facing. Yeah, that's it.
Well, I'd just like to ask, because until today I hadn't come across the term post-anarchism at all. So I just like, and I've like looked into some anarchist theory and that. So I'd just like to, if you can sum it up succinctly, I guess, what is post-anarchism in a nutshell? Like,
one thing is there is not, there is no one answer to that. There are different post-anarchist positions, and we try to give them and for some it's a marriage of the post-structuralist theories, especially seen in Foucault, Deleuze, and Derrida, and then some good parts of the classical anarchism. They kind of create a mixture for some post-anarchists. For others, like myself, it's post-structuralism was already part of the heterodox tradition, which has strong correlations with anarchism, and the post-structuralism in anarchism was already there, and we just need a new look to the concepts we have in anarchism, to the history and to the practices and theory, which is already there, but requires a new reading, of course. So then the post-anarchism becomes kind of this attitude of rereading the tradition in a well, in a way that claims it is an anarchistic way. Yeah, I guess I can say so.
I've been looking through the book, reading some of it, and it seems that a bunch of the articles are written, although it's just published this year.
Yeah.
A lot of the material is from the last 10 years.
Yes.
Some of it is obviously from the last 10 years because it's historical. Oh, this is part of the tradition.
Even like
some of it, yeah. And some of it is it's kind of funny to read it because like some of the people that you would have read would have changed their positions in some things, or you'd speculate that they may have changed their positions in terms of how their politics works out, and just maybe comment on to what extent is it an intended to be a reader, and to what extent is it intended to be because this is sort of brand new as a, you know, people writing on post-structuralist philosophy and anarchism, that it's just a lot of essays where it's the early work and stuff, and people trying to argue out some positions, or to what extent is the sense of a reader where like you go back and take up all the material. I mean, was that an ambitious title, a reader?
Yes.
You know, for something that doesn't actually have a huge amount written about it yet.
Well, it's growing, the tradition actually, and as you said, we use some articles which are already classics in the field, and founding articles, or they are supposed to be like that, at least if there is a kind of understanding on these articles. And for example, Todd Main's article is one of them, very old one, and he didn't change his position at all. But even if he did, it would still be a relevant piece, I think, to be in that. On the other hand, the richness of this post-anarchist literature, well, it's of course something to argue, but as we see it, it's getting richer and richer every day, and already it kind of marked the decade after the Seattle, etc. The main discussion after the millennium, the 2001, and all these years was this new field of this anarchist discussion, and then.
What is post-structuralism? Could you sum that up?
No, I can't actually. It's because it's a very complicated thing, you know, that the post-structuralist, the main theorists who are called post-structuralists don't want to be called post-structuralist. And so you have others who are trying to create categories to understand these, the working on the similarities between Deleuze and Foucault and Derrida and
Bataille. These are postmodernist thinkers, aren't they? So is there an overlap between postmodernism and post-structuralism?
Yes, of course. It's a these categories are mostly comes from secondary literature, actually. So, for example, for Todd May, Derrida is not a part of the main post-structuralist political thinkers. But I don't know. For many, Derrida could be a very important source of even post-anarchist thinking because of his contribution to texts and etc. Well, so post-structuralism is includes so many thinkers in the first place, and then also a very important secondary literature on it, and all the discussions on the and interpretations of Foucault and Deleuze and Nietzsche, of course, the post-structuralist Nietzsche, I mean. So I don't. I think it's a very huge literature out there.
I mean, that was the same with postmodernism. I mean, when that came out.
Well, with postmodernism,
in the 80s and the early 90s, I spent quite a lot of time looking into it, and I just kind of came to the conclusion that it's just a pile of bollocks, and just kind of haven't bothered to look. So would it be worth my time looking into post-structuralism, or am I just going to come to the same conclusion and just, is it just, and is it just like this academic kind of maze that you can wander off into and become of no use to anyone after you've got lost in this maze? Or is that a very incorrect impression I seem to have?
Well, for me, I can just answer personally, I don't know. But for me, post-structuralism and post-structuralist thinking was so naturally anarchistic from the first place. And when I became, I was 20 or something, anarchist, I just at the same time became post-anarchist. Because if you want to think more on freedom, as Matt says, or morality, or ethics, and normativity, and representation and anti-representation, you just end up in post-structuralist theory. It's the best kind of group of or links of theories that you can just think together with anarchism easily or naturally. It's just so similar that you can't help thinking them together. And then if you start to work on them, you see historical overlaps as well. But my first impression was not coming because of this knowledge. I didn't know that there may be some relation, but it just seemed the same thing, so similar, and making each other stronger. That's
For me, and I think that's one of the things the reader does really well, a lot of post-structuralist writing is very abstract and very academic, but the way it interjects with anarchism, the result of it, I think, has been to interrogate certain concepts like power, what it means to be free, and that has practical implications which work out through the way in which some of these writers, particularly people like Saul Newman, actually, who's very, very interested in trying to work out how you can make sense of something like an auto-globalisation movement. So, yeah, and looking at different ways of organising. So I think there are really sort of concrete, practical, political agendas in this. And the argument, really, that the post-structuralist position brings to anarchism is much more of a historical argument, I think, about the extent to which anarchists could do that without the theory, or without this new theory. And that's where a lot of the contention lies, because for some of us, actually, anarchists have always been able to do that. But for the post-structuralist, the claim was that anarchism itself had become very stale, so that it was thinking in certain sort of categories about class, that it was not thinking of the potential that existed to organise and engage in activism beyond what looked like very traditional kind of workerist frameworks. And that's one of the things that it's tried to open up. So, you know, I don't think it is... I'm reluctant to dismiss anything, really, but I don't think it is to be dismissed simply because it draws on a theory which is written often in very difficult and almost deliberately difficult terms. Because post-structuralism, one of the things about post-structuralism is it comes out of language and the ways in which language structures our thought. That's why it's post-structuralist. If you can play with the language, then you can think differently. And in part, I think, a lot of the theory that came out of post-structuralism was so obscure and obtuse because that was what was playful about the language. And, you know, you can get lost in all of that, but I don't think that's what the post-anarchists are about.
I forgot what I was going to say now, but I think it's quite interesting that very few criticisms of post-anarchism have been about the kind of post-structural element. They've been about the misreading of anarchist history, and really, I think it's only a matter of time before and I think Dwayne mentions this in the preface, before the term post just becomes obsolete, really, and it just becomes anarchism again. And in a way, it was a kind of, I think it's just a bit of a provocation to kind of get some ideas kind of. To throw things up again and get people talking about certain things again, like power and freedom. But I think you'd find, actually, and this comes out in the book quite a bit, that lots of what you take now for granted and what the movement takes for granted is pretty much what's being said here. And so there's this kind of, you know, it's not so much new as it's kind of holding a mirror to people, to anarchism, and saying, look at this, and it's a bit of a challenge, but without necessarily saying you're wrong and we should look at it like this, but to kind of just complicate things a bit. And I totally understand your frustration. And there's like this whole kind of star system, and to be a post-structural writer, you know, you have to be a genius, and this whole kind of sentence fetish of every you know, the title of every article has to be like a bit of poetry, and there's all sorts of problems with a lot of the academic presentation of it, and I think it's a real shame. And I think that's one of the things that's nice about this book, is that it makes it more accessible, because I think it's tragedy when you've got good ideas that are being hidden, basically, by their kind of obtuseness.
And indeed, the third section, which is part of what I thought was the real strength of the book, is what brings out the kind of how classical anarchism, that there was a lot of these ideas that life was a bit more fluid than, you know, the Queen's English had taught people in school to, you know, to learn, you know, by the meter. And that brings out something that it's always been there, but it's invisible if you're taught in a traditional method, or traditional political science doesn't see that. And so maybe that would be an interesting thing, is to see, you know, what will come from that in terms of studying, you know, having an understanding of the history of anarchism that really brings out some brand new things that are lost to people who do traditional political studies. Maybe I could add a question. This would be for all of you, in terms of it's exciting to see a growing rise of anarchists in the academy doing, you know, research. That's not, I mean, it's always happened a little bit, but that's not. What do you see as the role of both people in the academy or simply people, intellectuals or people who are writing, in terms of your, like, for example, anarchist studies, is that targeted at changing the academy and how political scientists think about things and thus how policy is affected? Is it targeted at getting people to think about, you know, who are movement based on movements and doing organizing work? Is it targeted towards the cultural industries, or is it another opportunity to get some, you know, get some publications in keep employment and do organizing in the workplace. I mean, I'm just kind of throwing out a million different ways you can go with this, but there's a lot of bullshit in the universities in terms of, like, we've got to get this many publications, and it seems like capitalism's attempt to measure, you know, efficiency, it doesn't have a way to say, to measure intellectual capital, you know, so it's now the number of publications people get, and, like, so these are, and a lot of that, you know, a lot of cultural studies is simply writing another clever book so that it gets published and people read it. And those are the people who have enough money because they have a pretty good education, and basically they're on the top end of the economic spectrum to buy those clever books. Mm-hmm. Whereas people in Africa and East Asia are on the bottom end of the economic spectrum, and that money is transferred this way. So where do you see the role of academics and writing? How do we get... is there a place for knowledge today in social movements? Where does that fit in?
I think that I'd like to think that there's always a place for thought. I don't know about knowledge, but thought. And anarchist studies started off and continues really to offer people, researchers, not just those who have academic jobs, but anyone who is researching, a space where they can publish their ideas. So you're talking to a community of scholars in employment or out or wherever who want to exchange those kinds of ideas. And I mean, I take the point about, you know, publishing in academia, but actually, I mean, it's worse than you suggest, because the idea now is not just that you turn out a number of items, outputs. Sorry, we're talking outputs per year, and that, you know, at the end of a period you have to count the number of outputs in order then to compete for research funding, but that you can only those that go into certain outputs count. And anarchist studies wouldn't be one of those things. That wouldn't be one of the journals that counts, okay? Because when it comes down to it, the journals that count are the ones that will give you citations. And if you go into Google and you put someone's name in, you'll see how many citations they have. And that's what universities tend to look at. But it's a place where people can exchange their ideas and research. And I think that's basically what we do with all of the things we're doing here. These are books that, of course, you know, anarchism is having its day amongst publishers. So 5 years ago, even, we wouldn't have got a book like this out. There's no way. You know, anarchism has become attractive to publishers in a way that it hadn't been before. Now, that seems to me to be a good thing, because it's better to have the thoughts out there than not. And it seems to me that one of the things that we can do in the very privileged positions that we inhabit in universities is to try and reach out and say, you know, why we think what we think and why we think it's useful to think in different sorts of ways. Because, you know, publishers will always sell stuff. It's not always going to be anarchism. So for the time that we can get the work out there, I think we should.
Can I just say very quickly, because we're running out of time, I think there's got to be, and this is certainly what I'm trying to do, and have been trying to do kind of outside of academia, which I've kind of left now. Gone on to making beer, which is far more useful. But I think there needs to be a real meeting. There's far too much rejection of theory within activism, a real kind of explicit rejection of theory often, and if you, any kind of discussions that are even remotely abstract can be shouted down. And although there's lots and lots of interesting anarchist academic work, there's still, I think, a shying away from getting into kind of more concrete questions. And if you look at, like, some of the anarchist email lists, you know, there was a discussion about the referendum recently, and I think that got about 4 emails. But if I sent an email saying, well, Kropotkin was a neo-Hegelian, you'd get about 18,000 responses. Like, there's still this kind of, there's still the kind of ivory tower thing. And I think I've tried to work, and I'm tr- tr- promote, and I think that's what we need to do, is to kind of get a meeting, because I think there's lots of interesting things to say. But again, but like with the post-structuralism thing, if you kind of you can say lots of interesting things, but if you don't talk in a language that people understand, it's going to rightly be dismissed. So we need, I think there's a lot that we can get out of this if it's kind of done in the right way. I don't know if you want to come. Thank you.
Thanks very much.